From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, Tesla has a new car again. It announced it Thursday night, which is why we're a little late recording this podcast. Thank you, Elon Musk. You can't buy the car anytime soon, but you might still be interested in it. So we'll grab Tim Higgins, our reporter, who was at the event last night and I think was in the car at one point, and we'll see what he thinks about it all. Later, we'll have an interview with Sarah Krauss, our reporter in D.C., who talked to Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, about the scourge on humanity that is robocalls and what, if anything, the government plans to do about it. So with me here, as always, Joanna Stern, who wrote a column this week about sharing photos online. Hi, Joanna.
Hi.
So we should mention, by the way, that Christopher Mims, who's usually here, is not here because he's off writing a column about the shooting that happened on Friday in Christchurch, New Zealand. 49 people were killed at two mosques. And the story has this bizarre tech angle that I feel like we're only just now starting to explore. There was this long manifesto, and the video of what's happened has been spreading all over the internet, and it's become this very complicated, very internet-y story. It's incredibly sad. The facts are still coming in, and we don't know a ton, but we'll have lots more coverage on that really soon. But in the meantime, Joanna, I want to talk about this column that you wrote this week.
Let's talk about it.
Because this is, I feel like, a thing that you've been talking about for a long time now, which is basically, what is the right way to share pictures and information about my child on the internet? And as somebody who doesn't have a child, I feel like you would have to start thinking about this like the minute your kid is born, right? Like you wrote about all these people who like didn't really understand the consequences of what's going on, how you share pictures and all this stuff. But like for you as a parent, when do you first start to think like, okay, what am I going to do about sharing pictures of my child online?
Yeah,
is that like
I mean,
a thing you sit down and
no, you don't. And so actually I say that in the column and I'm writing that for our newsletter that comes out on Sunday, but like, I don't want to pat myself on the back here, but I would like this column to be shared, like, at hospitals, like, or it doesn't have to be my column or my advice, but, like, I feel like there should be just, like, a short guide shared at hospitals or, like, for those who have had a child and, like, over in the, like, probably the last 3 years, I don't know actually how long they've been doing this, but in hospitals, after you have your kid and you go through all of this, like, you know, you meet your child and you do all the medical stuff and you're put in your room. The next morning, they sort of take you and they say, like, you need to go to this, like, quick parenting 101 class. And a lot of that's about how to feed and how to do all these things. But then they also say you need to watch this video on how to not shake your baby. And it's, like, pretty comical because you're just like, oh, why would we shake our baby? But, like, you have to watch this video. They make you watch this video. At least they make you do this at New York hospitals. And I wish part of, like, you had to watch a video on, like, safely sharing your child on the internet. Yeah, I mean, you don't really think about it till you are forced to think about it, I guess is the answer.
Yeah. So what was the impetus for you in wanting to write this column? Your child is not brand new. And, like, is this something you've been thinking about?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think I haven't, well, I'll just say, I mean, my child's about 2 years old. He, and I started feeling uncomfortable about sharing him on the internet or like more publicly on the internet kind of around like Cambridge Analytica time. I just started feeling like there's so many loopholes and things we don't know that's happening with our data. Why am I putting all this information about him on Facebook? And sort of started there, which I don't really get much into in the piece because I felt, one, I'm a little bit tired of writing that story. And I think we're all kind of aware about, you know, our info doesn't, we don't know where it goes on the internet at this point. I think for me, I had a public Instagram account, just quickly realized that like this is a very public account. And these photos, which are really, you know, they're personal, they can be intimate, they can be, you see lots of people sharing their kids, whether they're like, you know, right out of the womb, not right after, but like half naked when they're first babies, half naked till they're, I don't know, age 5 or 6. And this is stuff that you just don't want out there on the public internet. And so that's, for me, I guess, how it kind of all came to be that I just said, you know, for now, I'm not going to share photos of him out there. And also there have been some great pieces written in the last couple of months. There was a great piece by Taylor Lorenz written at The Atlantic about sharenting and how all these older kids now are looking back at all of this info and all these photos of them that have been shared since they were born. And these kids are like, what the hell, Mom? Like, I don't want this info out there. Why'd you share that picture? I look like crap. Things like that. And you know, he doesn't have a say yet. He, I mean, he can talk and he can repeat everything I say, but he doesn't know what social media is. And so until he knows, and until I think we all know a little bit more about where this info is going, I'm not sharing photos of him.
It is an interesting thing, like this question of, I don't know, who actually has the control over how this stuff goes out and how it works. And it's awkward in families and weird. But then the thing that really struck me particularly about your piece was that you found that the consequences for this are weirder than it seemed. And I feel like for most people, it's going to be this thing about like privacy versus, you know, sharing someone else's life that they don't necessarily have control over. But you also found these like deeply scary worlds on social media where they're doing things with pictures that maybe they shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, that for me, like, the control is the big question I have. What I really found out is that in certain instances, you actually have no control, and it's so crazy where these photos may end up. And yes, on one hand, there's child predators, and I spoke with a number of experts who said social media photos that you may think are really innocent of your child in a bath or playing outside in a sprinkler can end up, and many of these online child predator communities do have photos that are innocent and have been taken from social media that were public. It doesn't mean that they've sort of been doctored. It just means that this has become like the collection that they find on many of these people's computers can contain this type of social media innocent type of photo. That's one extreme. But then I like came across this really when I was looking at hashtags on Instagram just for the hashtag newborn. I came across this really weird role playing community. It's called the child role playing community. And people are pretending that kids that they find on or photos of kids they find are their kids. So they like sort of like dress up in a way, or they like pretend that they are they take these kids and they pretend that like it's their family. And so
it's so weird.
It's super weird. And look, it doesn't seem harmful, right? Like it doesn't seem that they do anything in real life with this information, but they are like taking these photos and putting it on their account and saying, look at my cute son Arthur, he was born today. Oh, look at him now, he's walking, or he's crawling, or he took a poop. Like it just like they try to make this a real thing, like kind of like a, I don't know, like a Tamagotchi or something. I don't know. And like to me, that just illustrated that people and I traced a lot of these photos back, and it illustrated to me that people just don't realize that when they share their photos publicly on Instagram of their kids, they could go to places you just don't expect. And so I traced it back. I did a reverse image search. I did a whole catfish situation. And I traced back one of the photos that was in the role-playing community to a couple of different parents. And then I called those parents and I explained to them the situation. And each of them made their accounts private within 10 minutes of getting off the phone with me.
Did they have any inkling that something like this even could possibly happen?
No. They were like, what are you, like, first, it was a really rough phone call to make, because at first they're kind of saying like, well, what's going on? I'm like, I don't want to scare you, but here's what's happening. And I would call them and ask them first to confirm that this was the child of a photo of their child, because I was finding them and didn't know yet, you know, is this the actual parent? And then I would tell them what's going on, and they would be like, you know, can you send me the post? And I would send them the post, and they'd just like, what? Why would somebody do this? Right. And they felt violated, right? They felt violated that a photo, and many of them were newborn photos, which are a good thing and a bad thing, right? The good thing is that, like, your kid doesn't really look like they did when they were born. But on the other side, it's a really bad, it's like, these are such innocent children. Why should their photo be on some random Instagram account? So, yeah, the parents were just shocked. And again, many of them, like, the whole, like, as I started doing the reporting, I started realizing, like, many people don't realize that a public Instagram account is really public, especially through hashtags.
Yeah, I think people think that public basically means easier for my friends to find me.
Right.
And not like actually truly fully public. Like I feel like most people now, when they want to take a picture, just sort of instinctively open Instagram or Snapchat or something else. And this whole like workflow of how we share stuff, it starts with the sharing, which is kind of weird. And now, like, yeah. Google Photos to me, which I think you mentioned in the column, mm-hmm. right, is like a perfect solution for this, where you can just send it. You say, like, here are the 12 people I want to see all my pictures. You upload your pictures and they get like a running stream of all your great stuff.
Yeah.
But that's much harder to do than to just take a quick video and share it on Instagram. I feel like a lot of people are going through this sort of reckoning right now for whatever reason. And it seems like I think about my Instagrams and my Facebook, where you go through that transition where it's like everybody's in college, and so it's everybody just drunk, and then it's everybody getting married, and then it's everybody having babies.
Yep.
And I feel like I know people who are still having babies, but I'm seeing them a lot less. And it feels like there is this small change that's starting to happen where I think people are, because of like broader understandings about things, are like about how the internet works, are finally starting to say like, wonder if this is a good idea to send this to my 8,000 friends on Facebook or post it on LinkedIn or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're bringing up
baby
something.
Pictures on LinkedIn is my favorite idea I've ever had.
I'm going to do that right after this. I think you're bringing up something that is really hard for this like generation of us that are having kids. And one day you will have kids and you will also feel this like inclination like, oh my God, something big just happened in my life. I need to share it. And that like, that's just what you've been doing for the last 15 years of your life. Like, it's a hard muscle memory to break. And I think the private sharing is the solution, as much as I don't want to agree with Mark Zuckerberg, and I think he's really only saying this for PR reasons, but I think the rest of us have actually already figured that out, right? We're using iMessage, we're using WhatsApp, we're using Signal, we're using all of these places to make private social networks that don't broadcast to the world, but broadcast to the most important people. And that was what social media was supposed to be about.
It does feel like, especially for, there's a whole generation of kids now who hopefully will grow up not with all of this stuff on the internet, but it's definitely got worse before it's going to get better. Yeah, it is. It maybe is only going to get worse. We might just be screwed. So on Thursday night, Tesla had an event, as they do occasionally, at this big design studio in LA to unveil a new car. It's called the Model Y. It's similar to the Model 3, only a bit bigger and more SUV-like. Elon Musk says it's going to cost $39,000 eventually. First, it'll be more like $47,000 to $60,000 or even more. The new car comes on the heels of yet another interesting month for Tesla. It said it was going to close stores, then decided not to close all of them. Then it cut the price of the Model 3, kind of. Elon Musk is fighting with the SEC. Everything is still insane. Anyway, our own Tim Higgins was at the event last night, and I think he's now sitting in a hotel room in LA trying to recover somewhere. So we're going to call him and see what it was like to see and maybe even ride in the Model Y.
Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Are you in a Y?
Tesla.
Are you in a Y?
I'm asking why.
Are you asking? Yeah, let's ask why. I'm going to make that pun a million other times.
So we have sexy now, right? This is the completion of the Tesla plan.
Absolutely. There was a lot of talk last night about bringing sexy back. I think all of the fans in the crowd, if not all of them, many of them, were talking about this idea. The idea was originally the company founded on the Roadster, bringing a sexy sports car to the market to get interest in electric vehicles. Because you have to remember, 15 years ago, the idea of a sexy electric vehicle was pretty out there, pretty crazy. And the Roadster really ignited the excitement for Tesla, early investors. And then the next thing was going to be the Model S, S standing for sedan. The bet was if they could create a full-size sedan that could compete against the likes of Mercedes and BMW, then they could really start to gain a following and traction, which is exactly what they did. The next vehicle was the Model X for crossover, a sport utility-like vehicle. It was a little bit of a struggle. They over-engineered it and whatnot. But really, the whole goal was to bring out the Model 3, the compact sedan, which was revealed in 2016 and began production in 2017, and has been a huge challenge for the company to get production going. And then the final part of that is the Y, a compact sport utility vehicle really aimed at the heart of the new car buying market in the U.S. and in China. And I know what you're saying, it's sexy. How do we get that? We got S and we got 3, which is a backward E, and we have an X and we got Y. So that's how we're spelling
sexy.
Yeah,
I mean, it's close enough. We'll count it.
Can you sing for us?
Can I sing? Well, my voice is so raw from last night.
From screaming Y? From screaming Y so loud.
Why? Right.
But actually, yes. Why? So, like, can you just quickly summarize, like, why Tesla and why Elon Musk really wanted this car?
You remember the Prius was kind of the first, hybrid electric vehicle that gained traction. That's a car. This push for the Model 3 was kind of conceived at a time when cars were the thing. But if you look at new car buying now here in the U.S., many car companies are getting out of the business of selling small cars. GM and Ford have been pulling back on those efforts, getting rid of it because they're just not seeing the demand for it. Elon Musk has huge ambitions for global sales, and the compact SUV market is really where the growth and excitement is.
So really, it's more about the model of the car, the size of the car, than the actual pricing of the car, because the pricing will probably work out to be closer to the 3 anyway, right?
You know, the question will be, and I've already heard it from some analysts, and, you know, they were a little underwhelmed with last night's reveal, in large part, I think, because it looks almost like a Model 3. They share a lot of the same parts. I rode in the Model Y last night. The interior was almost identical. The nuances that I noticed was I sat up higher than in the Model 3. They actually just put the seats on risers to give that effect. The back is different. It's a hatchback. And some kind of industry observers are actually just saying, is this really just a hatchback version of the Model 3? That hatchback allows them to have more roomy feel in the back and to sneak in a couple seats in a third row to give this small car the potential of having 7 seats, which is, a big deal if you're a family, though, you know, I'm not sure I would want to sit in the way, way back seat for like a long road trip.
Right.
Is it like those reverse facing seats with like the station wagon ones where like the kids are looking out the back?
An old Volvo.
Like, if Elon Musk brings those back, I will be so happy.
Well, I couldn't actually, I'm told that it's going to be front facing.
Oh, so
they're actual
like
seats. It's not like the Model S where it's, for kids in the trunk.
But it's still 5 seats, right?
The standard is 5, but there is an option for $3,000 to get a 7-seat configuration.
It looks so small back there. I mean, I'm looking at the picture. I have a crossover, and the hatchback is appealing. Like, it, you know, it makes it easier to throw a stroller back there or whatever, your, you know, luggage.
So this is what's so interesting to me about this car, is that it seems like this is maybe the most practical Tesla yet in that, like, even the things you're describing about what make it good and different are things that make it sort of boring, but in a good way. So like, Tesla's gotten this far by being sort of, I don't know, sexy and cool and exciting and making people, you know, pumped. But now they're going to tell you about how much easier it is to take your stroller and your half dozen children to soccer practice. Like, is Tesla going to be okay with being not nearly as cool anymore?
For all the talk about Tesla being an innovator and in changing the automotive industry, in a lot of ways, this is a classic play of what other automakers are doing. If you look at BMW, for example, their growth in the U.S. was going down market to the compact sedan market, the 3 Series. It really ignited sales in the U.S. And then they came out with the compact SUV, the X3, and that really took off in the States as well, and has done well in China, and is kind of the play that we're seeing that Tesla is doing. They started with the top end of the market, and now if you're going to get volume, you've got to make an attainable car that is going to be practical for people. So not surprising to see them go into the crossover market, but one of the things that was really highlighted last night was going to be the performance of these vehicles. 0 to 60, very quick sports car-like acceleration, because the batteries are at the bottom of the vehicle. It has a driving dynamic that is more sporty than maybe other SUVs. And so, if you're the soccer dad, maybe you're going to want this.
Yeah, I kind of want
one. So it's for taking
one.
Your kids to soccer, but like in a cool way.
Right, really quickly. But the question is,
I have a question. Okay. Does it come in any other color than this ugly blue?
Well, I saw a white one.
You saw a white one? And all the photos are like a blue.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the one that was displayed on stage, and then people were driving around in for test rides in the back.
But not in the very back.
Right. Right.
What a nightmare.
Joanna, you clearly were not ever like the youngest person on a long road trip with your whole family and had to climb over all the seats. This was my childhood.
The backity back. So we called it the backity back in my family.
The backity back. I love that. So, Tim, where do we go from here? So these cars are a couple of years out, but as we've seen with the Model 3, this takes forever. And like, they can barely make one car now. I guess three cars now, and a truck, and God only knows what else. Like, why? How long is it going to be before regular humans can buy these cars?
You can go on their website right now and put $2,500 down and order your vehicle. Deliveries beginning fall of next year for not the cheapest version, but the next level up, and the higher ones, the ones that are much more expensive.
But historically, those numbers are lies, right?
Well, many analysts are skeptical on the timing just because of the way the company has performed in the past and had a hard time meeting these. I mean, you're mentioning that, they've struggled with the Model 3. Well, they have to figure out a place to build the Model Y. They've suggested that maybe they're going to do it at the battery factory outside of Reno, Nevada. They're also building a factory in China for that market. You just got all these dominoes you got to put in together so they all kind of, fall at the right place.
Tim, before we let you go, I want to know, what are these events like? Watching them on streams, I get the sense you don't quite get the full vibe of a true Elon Musk party.
Yeah, so this one, my sense was it was more subdued, maybe going back to some of the early days where everybody was kind of part of this community. They were early customers. They were early fans of the Tesla experience. And in recent years, we've seen more of a spectacle. You would see celebrities. There would be, the press would be pinned off. The idea was, especially with the Model 3 reveal in 2016, they started taking reservations. And, they used that excitement to really propel the company forward. But this had, red lights. Some club music and whatnot, but it wasn't, people watching on the live stream, I think, probably didn't come away with the feeling that it was as heightened or as slick as previous presentations. I was standing right in front of the stage, and there was a whole bunch of fans all around me jostling to try to take pictures and videos of the whole thing. They were clearly had been drinking and were having a very good time, and they were really getting into all the double entendre jokes of bringing sexy back and, the sorts of things you maybe find funny after a few beers. That said, the new chairman of Tesla was also right there, and she was taking pictures of it and excited as well. So you had kind of this crazy mixture of early buyers of Tesla vehicles and the corporate executives and board there too.
I saw on Twitter someone in costume. Were you in costume?
I was not in. I mean, I dressed as a reporter. A Silicon Valley reporter. So I had a vest and Allbirds on.
I knew you had your vest.
I have a vest on right now.
Okay. So David, are you wearing a vest?
I am wearing Allbirds. So we're good. All right, Tim, you have other people to talk to, apparently, who are cooler than us. So we'll let you go. But thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And speaking of things that are surprisingly hard to build, coming up, we talk robocalls with FCC Chairman Ajit Pai.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access. Only for WSJ subscribers.
Welcome back. Oh, wait, hang on. Sorry, I'm getting a call. Sorry. But I suspect you're sympathetic to that, because I bet you've gotten a call like that too, probably today. Robocalls have become a daily fact of life. They come from numbers that look like yours, and they seem like they're legit. They're trying to sell you health insurance or convince you that you owe the IRS money. One robocall app estimated that there were 26 billion robocalls in 2018, and another said that number is actually closer to 50 billion. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, the government agency that's tasked with regulating this and other high-tech parts of our modern lives, got 232,000 complaints about robocalls last year. This is a huge, huge problem. Ajit Pai is the chairman of the FCC, and he says robocalls are his number one priority. But what does that mean? He sat down earlier this week with Sarah Krause, a telecommunications reporter in D.C., and myself to talk about what the FCC is doing and whether it ought to be doing a lot more. We started by trying to understand the actual size of this problem, and for that matter, why it's still a problem. Everybody hates robocalls. Nobody except the scammers behind them wants them around anymore, right? So why do we still get robocalls?
I think it's such a big problem because the technology has advanced to the point that these calls are very easy to unleash on the phone networks. It almost doesn't even matter where you're located. You could be on the other side of the world. You could still send some of these robocalls to American consumers. And that technological ease, unfortunately, is one of the things that has made this such a big problem for American consumers.
And what about our phone system led to it? How did we get here?
Essentially, it is the fact that virtually all of these communication systems are now based on the internet. So as opposed to yesteryear, when to grossly simplify, it was simply transmitting your voice from point A where you were to point B where I am, and there's only one path it can take, and that phone number was by definition verifiable. Now you have an internet-based system where there are multiple transmission paths to reach a consumer. The technology has advanced to allow spoofing so that the phone number can be masked and a false phone number can be added to your caller ID. And so the downside of the technological revolution we've seen over the last few years is that the folks who want to abuse the system to harm consumers, either annoying them or even scamming them, that advancement has allowed them to have a profitable business model.
Mm. And some of this has roots in our call completion rules as well, right? There was a time when you didn't want carriers to be able to discriminate against callers from a rival, and therefore they must complete the calls.
Exactly. That's part of the reason why early on in my tenure, we had to take steps to empower phone companies to block calls that were from obviously fake numbers, from area codes that didn't even exist. Because the traditional understanding, as you pointed out, was that we wanted every single phone call that was placed to be able to go through. And that might have made a complete and obvious sense 10, 20 years ago. But today, given this problem, we wanted to make sure that we are weeding out some of those fake calls.
Mm. And it's tricky, too, because there are legitimate robocalls and then there are illegal robocalls. So what forms of robocalls are legitimate?
So some of the ones that most consumers would think would be legitimate is if your pharmacy wants to call you and say your prescription is ready at this CVS or Walgreens or whatever, or if your school, for example, if your child's school has a weather delay and they say, okay, well, the school is going to be delayed 2 hours, so come at 10 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock. Those are the kinds of things that I think most people think are legitimate. It's the illegal robocalls that create the real problems here.
Although even within that, it gets tricky within legitimate calls because there's a difference between an illegal robocall and an unwanted robocall as a consumer, right?
Exactly right. And so for certain calls under the law that applies here, Section 227 of the Communications Act for the...
for the wonks out there.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure there are many of them who have studied this as much as we have. So there are certain calls to cell phones that require prior express consent or they can't involve telemarketing and the like. And so those are the kinds of things that typically would be unwanted.
Mm. And that's sort of a moving target right now, even in terms of what classifies as an auto dialer, right? Can you take us through where that stands?
Yeah. So back in 2015, the FCC made a decision interpreting the term auto dialer because the law, as it has long been the case, prevents certain calls being made from these auto dialers. Mm-hmm. The issue is that the interpretation that the FCC adopted was rejected by the United States Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit a couple of years ago. And what the DC Circuit said was, no, the FCC had too expansive a definition of auto dialer. The FCC's definition, according to the court anyway, would have made virtually every single device that's used to communicate an auto dialer from both the, everything except for a rotary phone, essentially. So iPhones could be converted into auto dialers and the like. So they said, no, we are bouncing that very expansive definition. And then they sent it back to the FCC to say, okay, you need to think about what the appropriate definition of an auto dialer should be. And that's one of the things we're doing as we're continuing to study the DC Circuit's opinion and some of the feedback we've gotten about it.
If that's not stringent enough, then consumers are at risk of getting even more of the unwanted variety.
Right. That is one of the concerns that's been expressed. And in the meantime, one of the things that has been suggested is that Congress should update this law, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. This law was approximately 28 years old. And some have argued that technology has advanced so quickly that it might be useful for Congress to take a fresh look at this problem, to update those laws and those restrictions in light of where technology is today. 1991 is an eon ago in the era of technology, especially the dynamic sector that we've got today.
I want to go back to this overly expansive definition of an auto dialer real quick, because it seems like the sort of thing where I think if you talk to a lot of consumers, they would tell you they're sort of happy to throw the baby out with the bathwater here, where like if people had to give up good robocalls to get rid of the bad ones, you might have an interesting conversation there. But what's the danger in classifying too many things as auto dialers and too many things as robocalls? Like, what happens when we trip over the line?
So some of the concern that was expressed about the prior FCC's expansive definition of auto dialer is that it would subject everybody, I mean, not just the actual robocallers, but virtually anybody who uses a smartphone, for example, who places a call that has not garnered previous consent, that could make them subject to TCPA liability. And so the argument would be even these innocent calls or, well, legitimate calls would subject the caller to $500 per call liability. And that's the kind of thing that some people express concern about.
And so, I mean, what do you tell your mom to stop robocalls? What is your advice?
I tell her the same thing I tell myself every time I see a call on my phone where the phone number has not been programmed in by me previously. I anticipate that if it is from the same area code, I have a non-Washington area code, if it's the same area code, and especially if it's the same prefix, the next three numbers, mm-hmm. it's most likely a robocall. So don't answer the phone, me or mom or you, anybody mm-hmm. else. If you do answer it for whatever reason, don't give any information. Just hang up as quick as you can. Additionally, you can always file a complaint. You can file with the FCC online. You can call our number. There are many tools available to you as well in the internet economy. There's many apps. You mentioned mm-hmm. one of them. There's several others, some of which are offered for free. They can help guard against the influx of those robocalls. Mm-hmm. But there's no question this is a huge problem. As you pointed out, the number one category of complaints we get, I hear about it all the time, including from my own family. And so mm-hmm. to some extent, we want to make sure that everyone, including the people who work at the FCC, have a seat at the Thanksgiving dinner table without having to get badgered about, well, what are you doing about this problem?
But that's kind of crazy, right? Like, that is sort of a fundamental erosion of the phone system, right? If the chairman of the FCC says, just if you see a number that you don't know, don't answer it, that's huge.
And that's part of the reason why we've cracked down over the last 2 years, taking every step we can, both in terms of our regulatory authority and in terms of our enforcement authority. We want to update our regulations to crack down on these robocalls, and we have really amped up the enforcement efforts. The largest fines in the FCC's 85-year history have been imposed under my leadership over the last 2 years against robocallers who've subjected Americans to, in some cases, millions of these robocalls, without consent, of course, and in some cases, scamming them.
But that's kind of tricky, too, right? Because actually collecting on those fines isn't something that the FCC itself can do. That has to go to the Justice Department, and they can either pursue it or not, or settle. And so, like, of the actual fines levied that go all the way, very small percent of them are actually collected, correct?
Historically, that has been the case before I got into office. But one of the things we've emphasized is that we want to have a very strong working relationship with the Department of Justice. We have stressed that robocalling is our top consumer protection priority. And unlike in previous administrations, once we issue what's called a notice of apparent liability, which is that we simply propose to impose this fine, once we adopt a forfeiture order, which is the actual imposition, mm-hmm. we intend to collect, because ultimately that money is not just important for the deterrent value. It's also important to send a signal to other would-be robocallers that you're not going to be able to get away with it.
Why not just require carriers to block robocalls?
So we have it. So last fall, I told them that we expected them to adopt call authentication, essentially a digital fingerprint for every single phone call. And although the engineering here is very complex, the concept is pretty simple. Every originating phone carrier would essentially have to sign, so to speak, a phone call as legitimate. And a phone carrier that gets that phone call from the originating carrier wouldn't carry the phone call unless it had that signature on it. And so ultimately, that call authentication framework would be the best way of solving the problem, because if you only have phone calls that are going over your network that are signed, then ultimately what that means is consumers would be able to pick up the phone with confidence, knowing that even if I don't have that number programmed in, I know all the phone carriers that carry that call have signed off on it as being a real number from a real person. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that is the gold standard, and that's what we have strongly told industry we expect them to implement in 2019.
Mm-hmm. And why sort of bang the table and demand it versus requiring it?
The regulatory process here would be much slower. We think that a technologically driven issue like this has to be developed by industry. And so we've put a finger on the scale, so to speak, in terms of urging them very strongly to develop these technologies quickly. And many of the carriers have done that. If you go to the FCC's website, you can see where I posted last month, the letter responses from 14 of the major phone companies in the United States. And you can see exactly what they're doing to adopt call authentication, caller ID, digital fingerprint. But I think the problem is, from a regulatory perspective, is if it gets mired in the administrative process of the FCC, that actually takes a lot longer and might not be as effective. And so our goal is to make sure that these companies know the FCC is going to be a cop on the beat, and they have to develop that technology and implement it this year.
And just to unpack what you're talking about with call authentication, it's your carrier says this started from a legitimate number, and then it's carriers throughout the system as that call is passed along are saying this is still valid, it's still valid, and you would see eventually a green check mark or something on your phone, correct?
Exactly. So if I guess one rough analogy might be to a race where you have several different runners carrying the baton, and the baton would only be handed off if the person getting the baton knew, okay, this is in fact a baton, mm-hmm. it's not a carrot or whatever.
Right. And but so, it won't stop all call. It won't, the calls will still come through if they're not verified, though. So like the actual phone ringing won't decline. It's simply that you'll be able to look at the screen and know that it's verified or not.
Well, so our hope is that this call authentication framework, in combination with the fact that we've empowered phone companies to block calls that are obviously spoofed or come from area codes that don't exist and the like, the combination of those two things would dramatically decrease the phenomenon of robocalling.
Mm. And what will it take to get to a rulemaking stage? Because that's sort of the or else, right? Like if the industry doesn't solve it themselves, then we will step in. What is that moment?
So, I mean, I've said that we expect it to be developed and implemented this year. And thus far, we're carefully monitoring how all of these companies are doing. And again, you can see it's how the 14 biggest of them are doing based on the letters that we've posted on the website. But if we get the sense that it's not going to happen, then we will step in. And under the Administrative Procedure Act, there are certain rules that we have to follow in terms of putting out a proposal, getting comments on it, and then ultimately taking action. And that is something I'm determined to do, because I think time is not on the side of the American consumer when it comes to this issue. I hear about it all the time. I'm sick of it myself. So that's one of the things we want to do, is to be able to take action by the end of the year. And we would prefer for it to be led through this industry-driven process. But if not, the FCC stands willing and perfectly able to take action ourselves.
Do you have a sense, David and I were talking before you got here about the fact that I get like one or two, a week. It's not too bad. But is there a particularly vulnerable population? Do you have a sense of who gets the most, and of the percent of calls that happen, how many of them are originating beyond U.S. borders?
Yeah, unfortunately, with respect to the first part of that question, we do get the sense that there are certain robocallers who are targeting vulnerable populations. A month or two ago, I highlighted the case of some Chinese Americans in New York who were bombarded with some of these calls, and the call pretended to be an agent of the Chinese government. I believe it was from the Hong Kong office or something, of the consulate. And so they were saying, okay, you have to pay this money, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. And if my memory serves, the consumers who were affected by this in New York City, in the New York City area, forked over something like $12 million. It was a huge amount of money. And this is just one case. And we see all the time that vulnerable populations like recent immigrants, like the elderly, those with disabilities, are preyed upon. And it's wrong in any case, but it's especially wrong when you're preying on the people who are very likely to respond. And even beyond those vulnerable populations, I mean, one of the scams that makes me sick is the IRS scam, where they call and they say, okay, I'm an agent of the IRS. You're in trouble. And if you don't give us this money or deal with us, you're going to lose your home. You're going to jail. And look, I know I'm current on my taxes and all that, but when you get a call from someone saying they're from the IRS, the hair on the back of your neck sticks up a little bit, right? Because you just never know. And so that's, we're relatively, I'm the lawyer who works in Washington, so I know the system, and it worries me. You can imagine if you're a consumer out there doesn't know that you don't owe this money, you might be likely to respond, and that's a terrible thing.
What's the best shot at solving it? What is the best, most promising effort underway, and will it be an all-encompassing solution?
I mean, I do think that call authentication, the framework that is known as shake and stir, those two technical standards developed this year, would go a long way to helping to stop this problem. Because I think ultimately one of the issues is every single phone call that you see showing up in your phone, it's handed from one person to another, and so what was meant to be a baton could well end up being a carrot or something, and you have no way of knowing. And I think that uncertainty is part of what really frustrates people, is that it's sort of like that episode of Seinfeld where Elaine, Kramer, I think, had signed up Elaine for the restaurant. Do you remember this? And so she was getting all these junk fax calls all the time, and she was debating, oh, gosh, should I answer the phone? Should I not answer the phone? And she ends up answering the phone, and she hears that 20 years ago, so she hears that whir of the fax modem, and just like, oh, it drives me crazy. And I feel a lot of people feel like that right now, and they don't want to answer the phone at all because they just don't have any confidence. And I think call authentication would be a way of restoring that confidence, so that even if you get get robocaller 2, it's not going to be this sort of flood of illegal unwanted robocalls that we have today.
So is there anything consumers can do right now to help? I mean, I talk to people all the time that, you know, they download Nomo Robo or RoboKiller and they put their names on the do not call list. And it seems like even the things that they do barely stem the tide. Like, are there things people can do to make meaningful improvement even in their own case at right now?
So one of the things would certainly be filing a complaint with the FCC. That does help us, gives us a hook, so to speak, in order to take enforcement action. And some of the most, again, this is our top consumer protection priority. And so the more information we get from consumers in the forms of complaints, the better chance we have of going after some of these robocallers and sending a very stern message to them and to their counterparts that this won't be tolerated. The second thing I would encourage is, and, you know, I know it's frustrating, but simply not answering the phone. I mean, I think the fact that this is profitable in whatever small number of cases leads these robocallers to continue their activities. And so simply not answering the call is a great way of you dealing with the problem. And I understand it's not optimal for now, but at least until call authentication gets fully implemented, that's one of the ways to deprive some of the folks who are bad actors from having a reason to do this.
I have one last question, which is basically, if you could go all the way back before this was your problem, before even robocalls were big, and sort of structurally change something about the way this system works so that robocalls were never a problem, is that possible? Like, is where we are now an inevitability of any system that can be exploited, or is there something we could have done a long time ago to avoid this happening in the first place?
With the caveats that I'm not an engineer and that I'm opining on the fly to very significant dangers, I suppose. I obviously wasn't around when the original structure of the internet was being discussed, but I guess one of the great things about the internet, of course, as it was originally architected, was that it was so decentralized that you didn't have to go simply on one path from A to B, but a packet of data could go on many different paths, and you would figure out all kinds of different innovative ways to send that. If there's some way to include, I don't know if it would be in the packet header or some other way of transmitting information, but some way to incorporate into that packet switching protocol a way of ensuring that the packet is in fact being sent by the person who's been legitimately assigned the IP address or phone number or whatever. I guess that would be some way of attacking the problem, but I don't know how else it could have been. I don't know how else you could have solved the problem back in the inception, mm-hmm. because I don't think anyone ever envisioned that you'd see this convergence of the telephone world and the IP world and the ease of spoofing.
Yeah, and you put it there as opposed to, like, because all of it ultimately roots back to Ma Bell, right? When Ma Bell was broken up, that's where call completion rules came in.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, the old rules from the telephone world, I think, were just sort of an ill fit for the internet. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems, to go back to Congress, is we're always urging them to take a fresh look at the realities of the digital world we live in. And it's just a very different place than it was in 1991, certainly in 1934 when the Communications Act was first developed. And that's a challenge as a regulator, is to figure out how do we best mesh these authorities we've been given by Congress in yesteryear to match the realities of today. And that's a challenge.
By the way, if you ever need an excuse for not answering your phone, you've got one now. Just say the chairman of the FCC told you never to pick up. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks to Ajit, Sarah, Tim, and Joanna for being here. Thanks to Tanya, our producer, and Wilson, our editor. And thank you for listening. We have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. Or I think you can just ask Alexa or Google Assistant to play most shows you might like. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.